and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extraordinary remarks by Donald Trump today, encouraging a hostile foreign power to interfere in our elections by asking Russian intelligence operatives to hack into Hillary Clinton's emails. James Bamford, a leading expert on the activities and capabilities of the National Security Agency, which also encompasses the offensive and defensive cyber espionage and cyber warfare of Cyber Command, joins us. He is a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine, and his latest book is The Shadow Factory: Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. And we will discuss the extent to which Russian hackers are extracting, selecting, and dumping damaging information on Hillary Clinton to help elect Donald Trump, and whether the U.S. does the same to influence foreign elections and our own. Then we will speak with Peter Dreyer, professor of politics at Occidental College, about his two articles at the American Prospect, Hillary Haters' Fixation on Sol Alinsky, and You're Being Ridiculous. The first deals with the bizarre obsession Republicans have with Alinsky, who Ben Carson accuses of channeling Lucifer into Hillary Clinton. And we'll also discuss the second article about how a small percentage of Bernie Sanders delegates are inflicting disproportionate damage on Hillary Clinton and undermining the two overriding goals of Bernie Sanders himself, defeating Donald Trump and continuing his political revolution. Then finally, we will speak with Tom Rochert, who served as a national security speechwriter for President Clinton and was a co-founder of one of the world's premier speechwriting firms, West Wing Writers. We will discuss his article, Politico, The Key for Democrats, Expose Trump as Weak, Not Strong, and the fact that nothing is more dangerous than a weak man with power, which Trump is, and Tom Rochert's observation that the number one job requirement for presidents is that they need to take the heat and stay cool. And joining us now is James Bamford, an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He's a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine and was a Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight, and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of American Intelligence Agencies, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He also writes for Wired magazine and produced the PBS special Cyber War Threat. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Bamford.
Thanks very much, Ian.
So let's begin with this extraordinary, I think unprecedented remark by Donald Trump today, essentially calling for the Russians to hack into Hillary's emails and encouraging a foreign power to interfere in our elections. Of course, if the shoe were on the other foot and the Democrats were doing this, there'd be a hue and cry from the Republicans, have always considered themselves the real stewards of national security throughout the Cold War. They always accused the Democrats of being soft on communism. And in the post-Cold War era, Karl Rove accused the Democrats of being soft on terrorism. So that in itself is pretty bizarre, don't you think, James?
Well, sure. And, you know, Trump does everything he can to jump into the spotlight, especially during a Democratic convention. So, you know, his remarks today are not very surprising. However, I doubt if he had any connection to the release of the emails in the first place by Russia.
So what's your sense then of this relationship, if there is one, between Russia and Julian Assange, who has a show on RT, who said that these damaging emails were coming, and they did come on the eve of the Democratic convention, and they have helped open wounds which the Democrats are trying to heal with their unity at this election, at this convention.
Well, that's what's really interesting about the sort of the cyber war activity of the 21st century, where you can, for decades, both sides, the Russians, the U.S., Chinese hacked each other's computers, but for intelligence information, in other words, to find out what future policies Trump might have or Hillary might have or whoever might have. What's different here is that for the first time, you've got a major power, Russia, and it's still unclear whether this was a direction of Putin from the top or whether it was somebody below him or maybe just one of the hackers who happened to be doing this in Russia. In any case, what makes it very unusual and very unique and probably sets a precedent is the transferring of the information that had been hacked by a major power to a middle person, which is Julian Assange, bent over to his sort of cubbyhole in the Ecuadorian embassy in London a few times and chatted with him. And that's what he does. He acts as a middleman for leaked information. It's just that nobody ever really considered that the leakee would become, Russia at some point. Most people would think it would be an employee of the NSA or whatever. So that is what creates this entirely new dynamic, having major powers using sort of whistleblower middle people as conduits for damaging information that could affect a presidential election. So it's very unique.
Well, but then the question then arises, James Bamford, is Julian Assange a neutral player, merely a conduit of information that could be damaging to whatever parties there are? I'm not sure there has been any evidence that he's ever released anything damaging about Russia, but how much does his own personal opinions and biases come into play? It seems like this person has extraordinary editorial powers, whether he exercises them or not.
Oh, exactly, yeah. I mean, I have no idea where Julian stands in terms of his political views on this current election. From what I've read, he's not a big fan of Hillary Clinton, and I haven't heard him say anything about Trump. So it does raise questions about where a person who puts himself out as a person who's a champion of whistleblowers, whether he compromises his entire legitimacy by sort of incorporating a nation-state power as a, in essence, whistleblower. You have to have, just like I'm a writer, I've been a writer all my life, I have editors who edit what I write, and if I write something that might be outrageous, they may flag it so I can reconsider it or whatever. And that doesn't seem to be what has taken place here. There doesn't seem to be any editorial judgment as to what is proper to release and what isn't proper to release. So I don't know how much thought Julian Assange gave to the release of this, but he should have considered the potential of being a conduit for leaking information that could be damaging to a legitimate democratic election.
And again, I'm speaking with James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He's a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine and was Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight. So let's turn then to what I suggested in the opening here, that while Russian hackers are accused of extracting, selecting, and dumping damaging information on Hillary Clinton to help elect Donald Trump, does the United States do the same thing to influence foreign elections and our own? On the surface, of course, we know that selective information led to the widening of the Vietnam War, which was complete lies about North Vietnamese attacks on American ships. That's an example. And of course, the more flagrant examples of more recently with the Trump, with the Bush-Cheney administration lying with false intelligence to get the U.S. into the Iraq war. What examples are there in terms of the vast capability of the NSA, which I mentioned in the opening, also has even greater powers because it encompasses the activities of cyber offensive and defensive cyber espionage and cyber warfare under Cyber Command. So in the last couple of minutes, walk us through some of these capabilities their capabilities, but intentions, perhaps, activities.
Well, just to start off, the U.S. Certainly doesn't come into this with their hands clean. They've been manipulating election since 1948 with the Italian election, and as recently as Panama when George H.W. Bush was here. I did an article on that for Rolling Stone that had to do with selling wars and things like that. In terms of NSA's capability, one of the documents released by Snowden was called Turbine, and what the document said was actually a slide that showed what NSA's capabilities were in terms of implanting malware around the world. And Turbine was a program to implant more than 1 million pieces of malware around the world. What you're doing when you do that is you're getting access to what people are communicating in various parts of the world. You're able to, and this wasn't just Russia and China, this was Brazil and other friendly countries. So the NSA has a great ability to find out what's going on in foreign countries. That's what its job is. And if the U.S. wanted to leak something, it certainly has the power. Whether that is going to happen in the future is hard to say. The U.S. has had a history of manipulating foreign elections, and this is one way of possibly doing it. And Russia seems to be a sort of leading the way or setting the precedent. Whether this will encourage the U.S. to do is hard to say. And there's various ways to do it. You don't have to leak it to the internet or leak it to Julian Assange as they did in Russia. You could just leak it to the opposition party. I mean, that's been done many times. So with hard copy documents, not necessarily digital documents, but you just leak whatever the bad news is you want to leak. You give it directly to a third party, to the opposition candidates. So this type of thing will probably happen more and more often as there's more access to this information. There are really only one defense. I spent 3 days in Moscow interviewing Ed Snowden for Cover Story and Wire magazine, and the thing he kept emphasizing for everybody is get encryption, start using encryption, and unless people start paying attention to that, unless the Democratic Party, if the Democratic Party had paid more attention to cybersecurity, than public relations and trying to undermine Bernie's election, then this might not happen. So the answer is encryption.
Right, but just to go back to the Vietnam War, remember that it was Richard Nixon's emissary, Henry Kissinger, along with Madam Chiang Kai-shek, who went to the South Vietnamese and told them to walk out of the peace talks that President Johnson had arranged with the North Vietnamese, thus extending the war and hurting Johnson's chances, or at least his successor, Humphrey's chances of being elected.
Right, and you also have to go back to Tonkin Gulf. It was actually the NSA that basically got us into the war. There were those two ships, Turner Joy and the Maddox, were intelligence collection ships sent by NSA, and it's a long story, too long to get into here, but the point was they sent out messages saying that they were being attacked. It turns out that NSA made a mistake. They weren't being attacked. And right. We got into a war. So it's a long, complicated story. But the Tonkin Gulf incident is certainly things that people should look at in terms of what happens when you start relying on digital information.
Well, James Bamford, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He's a columnist for Foreign Policy Magazine and was Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight, and is the author of a number of bestsellers, the latest of which is The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA, From 9/11 to Spying on America. And he also writes for Wired Magazine and produced the PBS special Cyber War Threat. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Professor Peter Dreyer about his two articles at the American Prospect, Hillary Hader's Fixation on Saul Alinsky and You're Being Ridiculous. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Peter Dreyer, who is the E.P. Clapp Distinguished Professor of Politics and the Chair of the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. His books include Place Matters, Metropolitics for the 21st Century, and The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. He has two articles at The American Prospect, Hillary Hader's Fixation on Saul Alinsky, and Your Being Ridiculous. So that was, of course, the Sarah Silverman moment that you're referring to there, Peter Dreyer. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Let's start with the first of your articles at the American Prospect, Hillary Hader's Fixation on Saul Alinsky. I think many of our listeners were probably just as absolutely amazed and completely nonplussed by Dr. Ben Carson at the Republican convention apparently going off script to say that Hillary Clinton was influenced by Saul Alinsky, who was effectively channeling Lucifer into Hillary Clinton. What is this obsession they have with Saul Alinsky?
So let's start off with who he is, he or was. He was one of the founding fathers of community organizing back in the late 30s and 1940s. He was a community organizer in the Back of the Yard neighborhood in Chicago, which is where the slaughterhouse areas were, meatpacking plants. And then he wrote a book called Reveille for Radicals, which became sort of the Bible for organizers for about 30 years until he wrote another book called Rules for Radicals in 1971, which basically is used even today by people doing environmental organizing, community organizing, tenants' rights groups, even labor unions. And so he was a rabble-rouser. He was a street fighter. He was a brilliant tactician. And he wrote these books to sort of help people figure out how to take power away from the powerful and improve democracy. He was not a communist or a socialist. He mostly quoted Tom Paine and Thomas Jefferson as his heroes and saying he wanted to restore democracy by giving people a louder voice. So he's not a well-known figure by most Americans. He's got a foreign-sounding and Jewish-sounding name, which allows people like Ben Carson and Newt Gingrich to basically spin conspiracy theories, basically, that Saul Alinsky is the devil, and he's infiltrated, or his ideas have infiltrated the Democratic Party. And if you listen to both Carson and Gingrich, they'll say that Obama was running his administration like from the Saul Alinsky playbook. Now, here's the interesting point about this. Both Obama and Hillary Clinton have a relationship with the late Saul Alinsky. Obama was a community organizer and no doubt read Alinsky's work. And was probably somewhat influenced by it. And Hillary Clinton wrote her senior thesis at Wellesley College back in 1969 about Saul Alinsky. So both of them knew about Saul Alinsky, probably read his books and so forth. But that was, 50 or 40 years ago for Hillary Clinton and 30 years ago for Barack Obama. But the right wing and now the Trump campaign and Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and all those right-wing wackos, they are trying to discredit now Hillary Clinton by saying she's a radical socialist, Saul Alinsky redistribution of wealth person. And I don't like to spend too much time reading right-wing blogs and listening to Fox News, but if you spend any time on the right-wing echo chamber and on the web, or if you listen to Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity, the next couple of months, between now and November, we're going to be hearing a lot about Saul Alinsky, and they're going to use it to try to discredit Hillary Clinton. And it's kind of crazy, but, it's a kind of conspiracy theory. But if Ben Carson thinks it'll help discredit Hillary Clinton, he'll keep using it. And no doubt Gingrich will be campaigning for Trump and using the same thing.
Well, of course, anything to do with the left has been beaten out of American politics. I think it seemed to happen, with that the enormous legacy of FDR having rescued the country from the Great Depression and in World War II, we had a social democracy, arguably from 47 to 77, and it's all but gone. But I think the thing that really destroyed the left in this country was the canard that was hoisted when all the paranoia about the Russians having atomic bomb, the idea being that if you were progressive on domestic issues, you were therefore aiding and abetting a foreign power. And as far as I can tell from everything about I've read about Sol Alinsky is that he was, in fact, a community organizer. He was, wrote a handbook for radicals, right? He wasn't a communist, or I'm not even sure he was a socialist. He was like Bernie Sanders, wasn't he? He was a social democrat.
Yeah, he was a social democrat, but he was mostly a street fighter who believed, for example, in making sure that people registered to vote, that people got stop signs on dangerous intersections. When he was organizing in Rochester, New York, back in the '60s, he organized a campaign to get the biggest employer in that city, Eastman Kodak, to hire African Americans for jobs because they had like 20,000 employees and only 400 of them were African American. So it was basically to make sure that the have-nots were able to get something out of the system. And there's still people doing that, still community organizing going on around the country. Obama was an organizer for 3 years, and he did some of that. He organized tenants in public housing to get rid of lead paint and asbestos and stuff like that. It's very issue-oriented, but the ultra-right and Gingrich and now Ben Carson, because he's kind of a shadowy figure, they can sort of say anything they want about him and say that he's associated somehow with Hillary Clinton. And so, we're going to hear his name a lot because most people don't know who he is, so people can use him to try to demonize Hillary Clinton. And in her autobiography, in her memoir, which she wrote about, when she was in the Senate, she talked about, I didn't agree. I wrote my senior thesis about Sol Alinsky. I believed in his, I agreed with him about making democracy stronger, but I disagreed with him working outside the system and protesting. And he once said that we have to rub raw the sores of discontent. He says, I don't believe in that stuff. And so she was, trying to show that she, even as a senior in college, that she was kind of cautious. That's the same Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. that we see today. She's not Bernie Sanders, who was more of a troublemaker and a lefty. She's kind of a moderate, middle-of-the-road person. So even though she kind of admired Alinsky, her senior thesis was mostly critical of it. But, Gingrich isn't going to say that. And all these right-wing websites, they're just going to say that Hillary Clinton's, what one person said is that Sol Alinsky was her role. In fact, that's what Carson said. He said Sol Alinsky was her mentor and role model. It's just not true. I mean, it's a lie.
Right.
But if you don't know it's a lie, then it becomes the truth.
Sure. And again, I'm speaking with Peter Dreyer, who's a professor of politics at Occidental College and the author of the 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. And he has two articles at the American Prospect, Hillary Hater's Fixation on Sol Alinsky and You're Being Ridiculous. And let's turn to You're Being Ridiculous, of course, being the statement that the comedian Sarah Silverman made at the Democratic Convention a couple of nights ago because of the almost enormous amount of heckling going on from Bernie Sanders supporters trying to drown out and being stimulated by any reference of Hillary Clinton. Boos would be issued forth. And, of course, Bernie Sanders himself, said it's easier to boo than to face your children living under a Donald Trump presidency. The thing that, I'm not sure that it's going to, at the end of the day, be as bad as a lot of people have thought in terms of the optics, because these things, these conventions are four-day infomercials in the hope that the American center will be beguiled into voting for you. So they try and put on the best show as they can, and they don't want negative imagery. So by now, do you still think, Peter Dreyer, that this small percentage of Bernie Sanders delegates are inflicting disproportionate damage on Hillary Clinton and undermining the two overriding goals of Bernie Sanders himself, which is defeating Donald Trump and continuing Bernie Sanders' political revolution?
You know, Silverman, Susan Silverman was a comedian, but what she said, she didn't think it was funny. She was very deadly serious, and I agree with her. That's why I titled my article, "It's being You're Being Ridiculous." So here's the dilemma, right? There are people that have spent the last year working really hard for Bernie Sanders. Many of them are young. Many of them are inexperienced politically. Many of them, it's the first time they've been involved in stuff. And they brought a lot of passion. They brought a lot of idealism into it. And they are now disappointed that he's not going to be the nominee. And they have some reason to believe that the elections were somewhat rigged by the Democratic National Committee and Deborah Wasserman Schultz. And so they're upset, they're angry, and they want to take it out on Hillary Clinton because they think she's too conservative, or that they think she's, too pro Wall Street or whatever. So I get that. I understand that. I was a Bernie supporter. I still am a big Bernie supporter. But at some point, you have to grow up and face the facts that there are two choices in front of us. Either Hillary Clinton's going to be the president of the United States, or Donald Trump's going to be the president of the United States. If Hillary Clinton's elected, then we'll have to keep her feet to the fire. There'll have to be lots of protests and civil disobedience and lobbying by the Bernie forces and all the other progressive movements in the country to hold her to some of the Democratic Party platform, raising the minimum wage, opposing the TPP, her platform, which is to oppose the TPP, it's not the Democratic Party platform, deal with debt-free college. All these things are really important. And can happen in January after she's inaugurated president. But in the meantime, we have to do everything we can to elect Hillary Clinton. And the 90% of Bernie Sanders supporters agree with that. And he has been working the phones and talking to his delegates and asking them, please, don't demonstrate and don't embarrass Hillary Clinton because you can cause a lot of damage. And the damage is not that she's not going to win the nomination. She's already got the nomination. The damage is that it's going to hurt her credibility with a lot of independent voters. And in particular, I'm sure you saw it. I'm sure your listeners saw at the convention a handful of Bernie supporters wearing masking tape over their mouths with the word silence written on it, okay? Well, that's harmless. That's protest. I teach community organizing. I love stuff like that usually. But that is going to be used by Donald Trump in his TV commercials. They're going to say the Democratic Party is corrupt. Hillary's corrupt. Even the Bernie Sanders supporters think he's corrupt. If they walk out of the convention, it's only going to be a couple hundred at the most. If they walk out of the convention on Thursday night when Hillary's speaking, that will become a Donald Trump commercial. They can't undo the nomination, but they can seriously hurt Hillary Clinton's ability to win. There are 10 battleground states. The polls show that in some of them, those states, it's going to be very close. Maybe the polls are wrong. Maybe it'll change. But right now, if the election were held today, there are some pollsters that would that say that Donald Trump could be elected president. And we don't need a neo-fascist, racist, homophobic bully to be the next president of the United States. I think everybody agrees. All your listeners agree with that. All the Bernie delegates agree with that. But by saying we won't vote for Hillary, by saying we're going to vote for Jill Stein, or we're going to write in Bernie Sanders' name, or we're not going to vote at all, regardless of their good intentions and their idealism, that is an objectively reactionary thing to do. Because if it in any way helps to elect Donald Trump, then it's a reactionary thing to do. And the movement for social justice, the progressive movement, will be fighting defensive battles for 4 years if Donald Trump is elected. He'll appoint reactionaries like Scalia clones to the Supreme Court. I mean, everybody knows the litany of harm that will happen, and yet it seems to me that many of those Bernie or bust people, and there aren't many of them, but many of them are not thinking seriously about the consequences of their actions. And the more they do that, there's 12,000 reporters in Philadelphia right now, and they're all looking for stories. They're all looking not for dog bites man stories, but man bites dog stories. So Bernie Sanders supporters walking out as they did on yesterday, on Bernie Sanders. It's a good story. And so the Bernie or bust people are getting much more media attention than they deserve in terms of their proportion of their of the numbers of Bernie delegates. Bernie has, like I said, he's got almost 2,000 delegates, and maybe 150 or 200 at most are part of this rebellion against him. Mm-hmm. But they're getting most of the media attention. So I do agree with Sarah Silverman. They're being ridiculous, and I'd go further, and I'm saying I'd say they're being reactionary. The left does have a program, and it's Bernie Sanders' platform. I wrote an article in American Prospect about a year ago, said, is Bernie Sanders too radical for America? And I looked at all the public opinion polls, and my answer to my own question was no. You know, 75% of the American population thinks that corporations have too much power and think that, you know, even more than that, think that we should raise taxes on the very rich. So a vast majority of American people agree with Bernie Sanders, but because of our campaign finance system and the way the media report and so forth, you know, that's not translated into public policy. And so Bernie Sanders, you know, a person that, it's amazing that somebody that calls himself a socialist got 13 million votes in the Democratic primaries. And so we are moving the country to the left. And Hillary Clinton might be, you know, too corporate for many of your listeners and for many of the Bernie supporters, but she moved to the left during this campaign. There's no doubt about it that the Bernie movement and Bernie himself pushed Hillary to do things and to say things that were against her better judgment or her instincts. Whether she embraces them now with feeling or whether it's just something she had to do politically. And if she's elected president, we're going to have to keep the heat on her. I mean, you know, is she going to raise the minimum wage to $12.50, much less, you know, $15 an hour? Well, that it depends on who's in Congress, whether the Democrats take back the House or the Senate. But it also depends on whether the movement that Bernie Sanders was the voice of and helped to bring the left together in this campaign, whether they keep going. And so, yeah, Hillary Clinton is not the candidate that most KPFK listeners want, but it's her or Trump. And what is more likely to bring about a progressive opening in American society, Clinton or Trump? That's the only question that we progressives should be asking ourselves. And to undermine Hillary Clinton's election and to give Donald Trump ammunition to attack Hillary Clinton during the campaign by walking out, by booing, by putting masking tape with silence on your mouth is infantile and self-destructive. And, you know, the young idealistic 20-year-olds that are there, I kind of understand why they're upset, but somebody needs to knock some sense into them. But the older people like Norm Solomon, who's helping to organize this, you know, who's been around for a long time, he's just being foolish. You know, mm-hmm. Susan Sarandon, she's a fool. She's been going around the whole campaign this year with Bernie saying that Hillary Clinton is worse than Trump. And that is, you know, that's just stupid.
Right. Well, Peter, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Dreyer, who's a professor of politics at Occidental College. His books include The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame, and he has two articles at the American Prospect, Hillary Hater's Fixation on Saul Alinsky and You're Being Ridiculous. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a former national security speechwriter for President Clinton about his article, The Key for Democrats, Expose Trump as Weak, Not Strong. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Tom Rochert, a founding partner at A&R Strategies LLC, who served as a national security speechwriter for President Clinton. He was a co-founder of one of the world's premier speechwriting firms, West Wing Writers, and he has an article at Politico, "The Key for Democrats: Expose Trump as Weak, Not Strong." Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Rochert.
Thanks very much, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And likewise, Tom, and I must say, the points that you make in your article, that in quoting you, nothing is more dangerous than a weak man with power, and Trump is weak, very weak. And then you go on to talk about your experience writing for presidents and saying presidents need to take the heat and stay cool. In terms of these being critical to the president's job as commander-in-chief, how do you, though, I mean, the worst thing that Democrats can be, and Hillary Clinton, by extension, if she takes this tack, is that all sort of liberals and progressives think this guy's a clown and a buffoon and they dismiss him, but they can't dismiss the fact that he's, even now, he's ahead in the polls. And Hillary Clinton's had some of the biggest political heavy hitters in history speak for her, and tonight the president's going to speak for her. And, you know, she's got all this weight in her corner, yet he's ahead in the polls. So what worries me is that we're dealing with an alternative universe in terms of the people who support Trump. And I'm not sure that reasonable and rational and logical arguments necessarily work on them.
Well, that is the question that's befuddled all the experts for more than a year now. Why is this man appealing to people when, if you divided all his statements in their component parts and polled them separately, you wouldn't get a majority? So what's happening here? And it seems to be the clearest analysis, the best analysis I've seen, is that people who are voting for Trump are angry. They're filled with grievance. He has become their vehicle for grievance. And so you really can't undercut him by normal means, by saying, but he says this and you don't agree with that, or he says that and you disbelieve that. So everyone's putting forward their best idea for how to bring him down. And the idea I advance in the piece is that the people who support Trump, who identify with him, they all have at least one belief in common. They think he's strong. And if they were shown the fact that he's not strong, if he were to be exposed as weak, then their appeal, his appeal for those people is going to drop. So how would you do that? And my point is, well, this would be hard to do if he were actually strong, but in fact, he is weak. He can't take the pain that every president has to take, to be confronted with attacks, continuous attacks, truthful and not truthful, on the person's self-image. This is where Trump's weak point is, because he is addicted to a self-image of he's a winner, he's rich, he's successful, he's strong, he's a great deal maker. But among them all, it's strong. And that's where we can start taking him down. If we can get him, goad him, provoke him into moments where he's not strong, and have people narrate that moment so people say, wow, you know, I thought he was a tough guy who talked straight. Now I see he's sort of a touchy guy who whines when people hurt him. That's where you start to cut into the support. That's the view I'm putting forward in the piece.
Well, indeed, I think efforts so far, I've seen some of the ads that Hillary's put out, tend to be what I would categorize as liberal self-righteousness, where you, first of all, your ads are on MSNBC, which is a waste of money because you already have those people. And they then they have all these young kids intercutting them with all of the foul and horrible things that Trump has said, and imitating the journalist with a disability, etc. And it ends up by saying, you know, do you want this guy basically influencing your children? You know, I agree that with you. I don't think the touchy-feely making us feel good about how bad Trump is, that's the stupidest strategy that they could be pursuing, and it appears to be the one that they are. What you're saying, it really makes sense to me. Let him hang himself.
Ideally, that's how it would go. And I agree with you that if that approach was going to work, it might have worked. And they can take a very, I think, a high-risk approach, which is to say, all right, we're going to let Trump supporters vote for Trump. We're going to go for the people in the middle, energize our base, get the vote out, and we're going to pray that it's enough. I think that that is too risky. I think you got to go for his base. And there are, we might see Hillary do some of this tomorrow, on Thursday night, but she's already begun it. And in what Vox called her best case against Donald Trump, Hillary's line, her soundbite of the speech was, "This is not someone who should ever have the nuclear codes. It's not hard to imagine Donald Trump leading us into war just because someone got under his very thin skin." Now, what was lovely about that from my point of view is the New York Times was interviewing Trump as Hillary gave that speech. And as Hillary said that, he said to the New York Times reporter, "Wait a minute, I don't have thin skin. I have the opposite of thin skin," which is gorgeous in a way. He took the bait. Because the thin skin charge is a trap. He can angrily deny almost any attack on his self-image and still sound strong. But if he denies he has thin skin, he confirms it. And the more strenuously denies it, the more emphatically he confirms it. And so he had to deny he has thin skin because he has thin skin. Now, this was just the beginning. And Hillary went back and she mixed in other messages later. She said, "Oh, he's divisive. He plays to fear. He plays to anxiety," which are approaches I think you and I agree are not terribly effective and won't undercut him with the people who now support him. But people have started this chant of thin skin. And if you're able to picture him, if you're able to characterize him as, "This is a guy with thin skin who can't take a punch," and then people start seeing this in a new frame, you have a chance to chip away. And ultimately, he's unpresidential. The dude is not cool. He can't keep it together. And the more that's the focus, the more his appeal will fade. We thought it was going to fade before. As long as it fades before November, it's going to be okay. But that's the view, I think, is start jamming him on thin skin. And I'll tell you, this bully misogynist, if he's called thin skin, if he's said not to be able to take a punch by a woman, it'll drive him nuts. And it'll be clear, he will demonstrate that he's, in fact, a weak guy who can't take a hit. And that's going to hurt him. That's, you know, that's this approach. And I think it ought to be tried.
So in terms, though, of what we're seeing now at the Democratic Convention and what we'll see afterwards, and frankly, an earlier statement of Hillary Clinton's I thought was just so wrong, where she said, "I can't wait to debate this guy." I mean, you don't want to legitimize somebody who shouldn't even be on the stage with you. But now that that he's on the stage and that the die is cast in that regard, what about undercutting the reason why the people that support him? In other words, I've seen enough of this unity stuff and the Democrats congratulating themselves, which is largely what these long infomercials are, known as conventions. But, you know, you can't deny, and you've already said it, people who support him really are angry, and they have reason to be angry, and there are good reasons why they are angry. Would it be useful for her to basically say, you know, "Look, I understand why you're angry," and go through the reasons why they're angry and basically say what she's going to do about the reasons why they're angry? You know, because we know that Bernie Sanders captured a lot of this same anger.
First of all, it's smart idea logically, but so many smart logical ideas don't play with these people. So I guess my analysis would be, where does grievance start? It starts with grief. There's something in these people's lives that's not working for them. Okay, it might be economic. Although in Elkhart, Indiana, when Obama went there in 2008 and they were in desperate shape economically, He came back 8 years later where they, by all their economic numbers, they were better, and resentment against the president was as high or higher. So in that case, the grievance really didn't have anything to do with the economic situation in Elkhart, Indiana, because it had made a comeback. So these people, they get their grief, and how does a grief become a grievance? You just wrap a story around it and tell people, this is why you're miserable, and this is how we can fix why you're miserable. And Donald Trump has inserted himself into their story. Your story is, yeah, your lives aren't as the way you want them to be, and the reason is Hillary and Barack, and the solution is Donald Trump. And honestly, that's a narrative that works for those folks. I think the best way to chip away at that is to say, you know, Donald Trump isn't your guy. And then you start saying, you start showing him in a way that is going to make them feel, ooh, he's not my guy. I thought he was strong. He was weak. He's actually a wimp. And Ian, one of the best ways to do this was oddly enough, shown to us by Chris Christie in the New Hampshire primary debate. And you'll remember the moment because he wanted to take down Marco Rubio. Chris Christie had it in for Marco. And Marco, in that debate, went into this riff that he had. Let's dispel once and for all this fiction that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing. It was a line that worked for Rubio again and again in the campaign. So he used it again after taking a shot at Christie. And Christie said, you see, everybody, I want people at home to think about this. This is what Washington, D.C. does. The drive-by shot at the beginning with incorrect and incomplete information, and then the memorized 25-second speech that their advisors told them to say. So Christie reframes what Rubio is doing. And then Rubio clumsily goes back to the same riff. And Christie jumped up and said, there it is, everybody, the memorized 25-second speech. And so suddenly Christie reframed what was happening with Rubio. And a line that used to work for him made him sound like a robot. Used to make him sound strong. After Christie reframed it, made him sound weak. And then a few days later, he finished fifth in the New Hampshire primary, Rubio did, and he was never a factor again. And you can trace it to that moment. So is there a moment where you get Trump out, you know, calling for, you know, telling media that they're losers, telling a bunch of senators that they're losers, complaining about his tax returns, ranting like a child, whining like a guy who didn't get his way, and then enough of the frame has shifted so people don't see that as strong. The problem with the Trump supporters is they're confusing force for strength. Trump is forceful on the stump. He's filled with anger and insults and threats, and that's forceful. But it's actually hiding weakness. So I think that's the point. Reframe him, provoke him, and then narrate it for people. And I think that's that, not to abandon all the other things people are doing, not to abandon appeal to the middle, get out the vote, fire up the base. All those pieces have to be there. But this is a way where I think we get him to expose himself as not tough enough to be president.
Well, Tom Rochette, it's just so baffling to think that at this moment you have a presidential candidate who is a Republican basically calling on a foreign hostile power, encouraging them to interfere in the American elections. If a Democrat were doing that, it would be over. This would, you know, throughout the Cold War, the Republicans painted the Democrats as being weak on communism. And then in the post-Cold War, Karl Rove tried to paint them as being weak on terrorism. And here you have the tables turned. And frankly, I don't understand why the Republicans aren't, even his own vice president, by the way, has distanced himself. So we both agree there's something deeply wrong here. I think you've hit on the Achilles heel, because I've seen him on the stump spending maybe 20 minutes, sometimes half an hour, just with petty payback about what people had written about him. I mean, really petty stuff. So I guess that's what you're saying. And so who does the needling here?
Oh, I think that whether it's the media, first of all, has begun to pick it up, and the Democrats are talking about thin skin. But if there's enough of a narrative around thin skin, then it's the background of every time we engage him. But Ian, I want to make a point about Trump encouraging a foreign adversary to spy on a presidential candidate. My contention is, you know, that Trump, it's a president needs to be able to dismiss these personal attacks, insults, setbacks, needs to be able to dismiss them and keep his or her mind focused on the job. That requires a lot of strength. You got to let things go. But Trump, he can't dismiss an attack and get back to the mission because his image is the mission. And so he's got to be a winner. That's part of his image. He's got to be a winner. So what happens when he's in a situation where someone is threatening his image as a winner? Anything is okay for him then to attack the threat to his being a winner. That's what I'm saying. He has no self-awareness. For him, his self-image is the supreme value. Nothing else matters. His self-image runs his life. If he becomes president, his self-image will run our country. Right now, his self-image is running his campaign. There isn't a political advisor in his camp who would have recommended that he say what he said today. They don't matter. Only his self-image matters. So I predict we will see more and more outrageous things from him as his self-image of being a winner comes under greater pressure. As the scrutiny of the media pokes holes in his mask, he is going to be more and more outrageous. And if we can frame it and narrate it and say, this is what a weak guy looks like, look at him be weak, there is a chance that we can get enough of his support to crumble so that we're not nervous when we get to November. Right now, if November 8 were tomorrow, I'd be trembling. I think much of America would be trembling. I'm hoping that we see polls when we get there that show that, you know, Trump support has dwindled to a number that is going to guarantee a landslide against him and his party.
But Tom Rochette, clearly the people that support Trump do hate the so-called mainstream media or what they call the liberal media, and they are not listening. The more terrible things the media says about him, the more they will circle the wagons around him. So I guess what you're telling us is the role of the media, which, you know, should be to publish the truth, then we do have this sort of leftover from the 18th century Age of Enlightenment, the assumption that once you provide the better argument with all the facts and reason to back it up, you win the argument. But Karl Rove has proven there's such a thing as emotional intelligence, and George Lakoff has written a lot about it, how the Democrats don't frame their arguments as well as the Republicans do in terms of for example, the best example would be pro-life as opposed to pro-choice, you know, which is the stronger framing there. So in terms of a frame, is there any suggestions that you have? Because that seems to me...
Yeah, I would say that the frame is a president. Presidents have to be able to take a punch and act like they never got hit.
Right. Well, your line that says presidents need to take the heat and stay cool is an awfully good line, and so is your line that nothing is more dangerous than a weak man with power. So those are two pretty good places to start.
Well, if that, now you made the point that the media, what's the role of the media? And part of the role of media is not just to publish the truth, but report what people are saying. So if Trump in a debate situation would be interesting because someone would say, well, Mr. Trump, there's quite a number of people who say you're not tough enough to be president, that you have thin skin, that it could lead us into war. I mean, you could imagine Trump is president. And we know that when he's running for president, he's worried about his personal class action lawsuit against him, which is a personal, not a political, not a public thing. He's worried about his golf course in Scotland and said, you know, when the pound suffers, it could be good for his golf course. So his private interests are dominating his mind even when he's running for president. So when you say, well, Mr. Trump, just imagine that terrorists hit Trump Tower when he's president. Imagine they hit some of his other business interests, which you would imagine they would. Is he going to use the United States military to try to settle a score against people who damaged his business interests? It'd be hard to argue that he wouldn't, given what we've seen from him. So I don't think that his people need to hear a story in the media or hear some comment from a source they distrust to lose their faith in him. They need to see Donald Trump on video losing it over and over. And even they will have to say, well, I don't like Hillary, but I'm really discouraged because I thought Trump was my guy. I thought he was strong, and clearly he's not strong. And then they get discouraged and disillusioned, and they stay home.
Well, Tom Rochette, from your lips to God's ears, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian. It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Tom Rochette, who's a founding partner of Strategies LLC, who served as a national security speechwriter for President Clinton. He was the co-founder of one of the world's premier speechwriting firms, West Wing Writers, and he has an article at Politico, The Key for Democrats, Exposed Trump as Weak, Not Strong. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Federico Garcia and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And this program will be available at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow. Bye for now.